again, it's like, it's not like kind of like a scientific analysis. You know, it's like you have a spectrum of high pleasant to high painful, and on it you have kind of like around here in the middle something which is more, the Buddha generally described it, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So again, I presume people also have different sensitivity, but what personally I would say I would experience over time, it seemed to me that that place which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, personally generally I feel as relatively pleasant, because I find it very peaceful and I don't find it boring. So yes, I mean it's very kind of, you can't say, oh, here it starts, there it starts. I think it's just kind of like difficult to see, but you can see shades. And then you can also find, I mean, that's what I find, that often I am in what I would call this stable and open place, or quiet and clear place. And then you could say it's relatively neutral, neither pleasant nor, with a little kind of a feeling of pleasant, because there is, I would say, inner peace or inner contentment. But it's not, there is no excitement about it. But Stephen also has an interesting idea about neutral. So.
I don't really think there's such a thing. And I wonder if, because as everyone says, if it's neutral, it tends either to be peaceful, which is nice, or boring, which is not. So where's the neutral gone? It's disappeared. I think that the point that's trying to be made is to show that in any experience we have, that will take place within a spectrum between agony, extreme pain at one end, and ecstasy and bliss at the other. And so when anybody asks you, how are you feeling? At some level, you can sort of locate yourself somewhere within that spectrum. I think it misses the point slightly to try to pinpoint what neither pleasant or unpleasant means. I think it's simply a term that points to the fact that we're talking about a range of emotional or hedonic colouring to experience.
But I think what was interesting is that generally, if you in the text, often the Buddha will equate it with equanimity. Often that's what he will do.
You see, the word in Pali for neither pleasant nor unpleasant is upekkha, which also means equanimity. And I wonder if the point, in fact, is to cultivate equanimity with regard to this entire spectrum, so that one is not pulled by what is pleasant, one is not averse to what is unpleasant, one is somehow more and more able to accept, to recognize, to be with whatever feelings are coming up. And that would be closer to this quality of equanimity, which I think is the more important point.
Yes, it just small. It reminds me of automatic car. There is drive and there is reverse and there is neutral, which is just not driving. It's not good or bad. It's just not back and not forwards. And when I go to park to pee, that's sort of equanimity, because then I can calm down. So technical.
Good point.
You made a point in the beginning that one of the differences or the unique things about the Buddha's message was that he said that every person can attain awakening regardless of the caste system,
mm-hmm.
and which was, I don't know if you said, it was even revolutionary or very, very...
It was revolutionary in the sense that he presented a Dhamma, a teaching, that was not in any way aimed at a particular segment of the population.
Okay. So my question is, I've heard different things about the place of women, and I think they were, you could say, discriminated along the history in terms of the place they could have in the
sangha, in the community.
Yes, and I wonder if the Buddha said anything explicit about it, or how do you see it in relating to this point of the Dharma is universal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to see what the Buddha is doing in the context of his time. As far as I understand, there were no other orders at the Buddha's time of meditators or spiritual practitioners who acknowledged that women could achieve the same degree of insight or liberation or awakening as men. And the Buddha said, yes, they can. That's quite clear. Oh yes, absolutely. And so the in terms of the capacity to realize the goals of the path, to become, in the classical terminology, arahant, completely liberated, men and women had exactly the same capacity to do that. That is clear. Now, in the history of Buddhism, it becomes a slightly different story. And this, I think, has to do more with the fact that in most societies that adopted Buddhism, you had very strong patriarchal structures of power in place. And if you take Tibet, for example, the full ordination of women never went to Tibet. Women were only ever able to receive samanerika, the novice vows. There was not a great deal of funding or support for women practitioners. And this is true in not all, but in some Buddhist countries in Asia. There's also the fact that in the Vinaya, in the monastic rule, the Buddha accepts women into the order under a certain amount of pressure. Ananda has to persuade him to accept his aunt, Mahapajapati, who was the woman who raised him in lieu of his own mother who had died. And then the Buddha accepts women, but insists that they have 8 sort of additional rules, which does somehow discriminate against them.
But I think the rules were very likely to kind of work with a lot of his monks were from the Brahmanic caste. And so the rules were basically either to protect the nuns so they were not far away where they could be attacked, or to say that they were slightly inferior, not inferior in capacity, but in status, that a monk would not have to bow to a nun, but a nun would have to bow to a monk, things like that. So that kind of, it kept the monk kind of top, and the nun came later. But an interesting book is the Terigata, which is actually the psalm of the sisters, which were the nuns who were awakened at that time. And you can see their record and the poetry they wrote and their experiences of awakening. And I must make a correction from what I said this morning, because the last thing I said about, you know, when as long as it's pleasant, etc., etc., that actually the Buddha did not say. But it's canonical, it's in the canon, the Pali canon, but a nun said it. So something that a nun said was kept in the Pali canon because it was good enough to be there.
I think the Buddhist canon is the first set of texts in India that has a body of writings that are written composed by women. So in that sense, it's a very significant break with tradition. But nonetheless, I think there were women were accepted into the order of the Jains also, but were not regarded as capable of achieving the final goal because they were not allowed to go naked, which was one of the Jain practices, still today in the Digambara Jain school. And it's also clear from the Pali canon that when you hear about these renunciants, the samaneras, the wanderers, one tends to think that they were all men, but they were not. there were both female and male renunciants at the Buddha's time who were wandering through India in search of knowledge and understanding. So it appears that even prior to the Buddha's acceptance of women, there was, in this rather turbulent time in Indian history, the beginning of a certain emancipation for women from the constrictions of staying in the household and having children and so forth and so on. So things were changing.
But then, kind of, history, kind of, in some places it developed better than in others. Again, this is very cultural. Over there? It's kind of what is it that we look at, and what do we do with it? Because it's what we choose to look at, and really, and what we do with it. You know, you can be aware of the pleasant, and then it will pass, and then there will also be unpleasant, and it will pass.
Yeah, but I thought I was giving much more attention because.
Yeah, so I mean, it could be a good bit of information. I am not sure that you necessarily have, you know, to judge it, but it's to see how much do I do that, which then means that I am not so aware of what is unpleasant, and then later it might become difficult. But if it's not difficult, then there is no problem. I think it's kind of also to see. I mean, we like to go one way or another. There is that intention of the mind.
I mean, what you find in the text is the Buddha says, when you experience a pleasant feeling, you know that it's a pleasant feeling. When you experience an unpleasant feeling, you know it's an unpleasant feeling. That's the primary point. It's to recognize what is happening for what it is. The problem begins when you think, I like that. I think I want more of that. I'd like to hold on to that. I'd like to get the object that I associate with that. It's when, and that's the beginning of craving. I mean, in the way the Buddha describes the conditioned arising, there is contact, there is feeling, and it's at that point that the danger of slipping into aversion, into attachment and desire and craving, of wanting, of not wanting, of getting caught up in the demands that we instinctively somehow get caught up in. That's the point at which one can begin to make a break with habitual behavior, the grasping, the craving, and so on, and simply remain conscious of what is taking place. And noticing also at the same time that urge, that impulse, that drive. You notice craving as craving. You notice aversion as aversion. You're not trying to somehow suppress something. You're not trying to magnify something else. But it's about, through this sort of practice, learning. I mean, I think equanimity is a very important quality here. Learning simply to experience what's happening in terms of what it is, without embellishing, exaggerating, proliferating, getting caught up in stories, getting caught up in plans and projects to get this and get rid of that. It's trying to establish a kind of emotional baseline within oneself, so that one begins to live not from the force of attachment and aversion and habit and so on, but one begins to live from this basic sort of sanity, clarity, and stillness with regard to what's taking place, to to begin to find a ground from which you can respond to that wisely and compassionately and calmly, rather than it triggering this turmoil of reactivity.
Maybe in terms of what you were saying, in terms of just observe. For one walking, you concentrate more on the positive feeling. Next one, you concentrate more on the negative. Then you see, does it make any difference? Possibly not. So it just, again, when you find this, because you see, it's true that we can be aware of different things. Like, it's back to what is in the foreground, what is in the background. But the fact that you see more the pleasant for a little while doesn't mean that in the background you're not aware of the unpleasant. And then you might do something about it or not. So you might put the air back up, and then it's not there anymore anyway. So it's kind of to see, oh, I seem to be doing this. What does it do? What happens then?
Yes, and then one, two, three, okay. Yes.
Dr. Buddha speaks about teaching children, like what his help is, teaching Dhamma to children, only concentration, also mindfulness.
Did you hear the question at the back? The question had to do with, is there anything in the canon where the Buddha talks of teaching children? Does he encourage them to practice concentration or mindfulness? As far as I'm aware, there's nothing in the canon where the Buddha addresses the issue of raising children. Certainly in terms of encouraging certain spiritual practices. He does accept into his order his young son Rahula at the age, I think, of 7 or 8. But at the same time, he then introduces a rule that from then on, someone qualified to enter the order has to be 20 years old. So that implies that he's concerned primarily with working with adults. And there really is very little in the canon concerning children.
But nowadays there are lots
nowadays it's another story.
Nowadays there are lots of people working in that field with younger children, teenager, and so there are many books and many people devising different things. But I think it depends what age. When I was in England, I used to go into school and teach meditation. And you know, if you have with 10 years old, I would just do a minute of breath, a minute of sound, a minute of body. And then they would say, oh, it's so relaxing, but very short, very short, and make it more as fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Then?
Yeah.
Earlier today, you spoke about two things I would like you to expand more on and to ask also a few things about. You talked about what prevents us from loving. And you mentioned the different feelings or emotions that prevent us from loving. And I wanted to ask more about how do you deal with those feelings that are obstacle to love, only by mindfulness, or I don't find mindfulness always helpful in those cases, so that is one thing. And the other, you talked about how as we grow up, we have these fixations on ideas and interpretations. But this is also one way to interpret reality, and one way to understand it. And I mostly find it very, very helpful, but there are times that I'm not sure that this interpretation is better than others. And I'm trying to focus or to find the questions that help me to make sure that this sort of interpretation is better in different situations. And
I don't quite understand. What do you mean, this sort of interpretation? Which
like
one?
The Buddhist interpretation of reality or of human experience. So when there's a situation that I'm not sure how to respond to, or how to relate to, so questions like what is the intention between. This is very helpful in this situation. But and asking myself, is this like an act of love, the way that I relate to another person, and not judging and accepting. But then it's also just one way.
Yeah, sure. In terms of qualities like love and compassion, there's a twofold approach. First is that of recognizing what it is that inhibits those feelings, and I think the classical idea will be that of well, obviously self-centeredness, selfishness, self-concern, which is clearly quite a primary obstacle to realizing any of the goals that the Buddha values. And obviously, if you're self-preoccupied, that will be a very clear obstruction to really opening your heart to others. Likewise, attachment and fear and hatred and so on. So whatever practices one uses, be they mindfulness or be they concentration, or in many respects simply an ongoing reflection and consideration of the nature of experience. This evening I'm going to come back to this point, so I won't go into that too much now. But there is also positive attitudes that one deliberately cultivates. One cultivates a feeling of loving kindness, of compassion, that one consciously wishes others well, whether that be in meditation or simply as an attitude, as a perspective one seeks to embody in one's life, reaching out to others, being more and more sensitized to the suffering of others. To me, the crucial thing really is to be able to, is to begin to pay more and more attention to the fact that there is suffering in the world. That, I feel, is very central to unlocking one's sort of compulsive self-regard, to be open to that. And such openness, I think, is achieved on the one hand by learning to be more calm and more still, but more than anything else, simply learning to notice. The word sati, mindfulness, also means recollection, to remember. And so the instructions in mindfulness are not just instructions to be more attentive to the body and the feeling, but also to recollect, to remember, to call to mind the reality of suffering in the world. And in fact, in the structure of the teaching of mindfulness, in the Satipatthana Sutta, it concludes with the Four Noble Truths, the first of which is the opening of oneself to the reality of suffering.
I want to be a little more concrete. Okay.
A little bit more concrete,
yeah.
Okay.
So it's a little abstract. And to connect between the two other things I was saying, I am in a situation where I feel two very strong feelings, either very close and loving and feeling kind to another person, and then as things arrive and pass, I could feel alienated or very angry, maybe not very angry, but very far away from that person, and it's just too much.
Yes.
And I feel I want to be able to develop the feelings of either equanimity towards that person, or just to help the love grow, instead of feeling these two ambivalent feelings very, very strong.
I feel it's also important. I think awareness can actually show us that actually sometimes we have coexisting feeling, which might be totally opposed. And it's very interesting in a way to then look at the conditions, you know, what is going on in myself, in the outer condition, and to see what also are the association. What I find interesting when we love someone, that it be a child, that it be a partner, that it be a friend, is to look at the experience of being with the person but also to look at the stories in our head about what it means to love somebody, what it means to have the feeling of loving someone, and also the abstraction we might have. When there is a love, there is a lot of thing going on. And I think the awareness can help us to see, wait a minute, what is going on here? You know, and to see that, you know, to me, love is kind of actually a great challenge. Because if we love someone else, in a way, it has to start with acceptance, what I would call creative wise love, accepting the person fully. And then from that place, trying to talk about what is difficult. And also to acknowledge, it's back to the limit, to see how much can I change, how much can the other person change. Because often, the problem is not with the feeling. The problem is not with the love. The problem is with the habits. I think between people, often when they love each other, the problem is not with the feeling. As the feeling arises, no problem. The problem is with the habits, that we have different survival mechanisms, different habits. And often our habits don't fit. And so we think, well, if they love me enough, they would change. And the other person thinks the same. If she or she loved me enough, they would change. But they cannot change. We cannot change for the other. I mean, we can work on it. Because we see the other person, we become more aware of, in this condition I do this, in that condition I do that, and that create this, and that create that, and then there is pain, and then we can see what goes on. And then we have to see how much can I limit certain automatism, can I dissolve certain automatism. But this is kind of like, in a way, a big story. Not something we can talk about in 2 minutes, because it's a lot of things coming together. And so, of course, meditation is not the only remedy, but I think awareness, creative awareness, can be very useful in order to look at what is it I am telling myself? What is it I am feeling? What is my effect on the other? What is the other effect on me? Is there any creative thing I can do here? And so at that level, there is no rule and regulation, because in a way, you have to respond to the moment from yourself and to the person. In terms of the past, what we can see is, when is it? When do problems happen? What is it? Where does it stick? What is the difficulty? Can we do something about that difficulty or not? Do I accept it? Do I transform it?
Buddhism certainly doesn't have a set of answers to your particular problem there. You won't find any text that will say what you should do in this situation. All that the Dhamma gives you is a sort of framework. It gives you a perspective. It encourages certain qualities and certain values. But in any actual situation between two people, you cannot make any prescription. You cannot. There's no rule book. There's no text anywhere that will say, "Okay, now you do this." The challenge of the practice actually is to learn how to transform these rather abstract values into concrete acts, and that really is the practice. And the practice is only something a flesh and blood human being can do in a specific flesh and blood human situation. And that's your responsibility. You may find that these values and these practices and so forth do not actually help, in which case you should look elsewhere find some other approach. But that, of course, is entirely up to you. But that's, I think, all that the Dhamma gives you is a template, really, that may or may not work in your case. This gentleman in the yellow shirt.
You seem to be saying that, as opposed to, say, a magical procedure, some kind of secret way of returning to Atman, a round of doing, this is a cultural or moral or philosophical achievement that's kind of an ongoing work to attain the sanity of the one position by creed.
That's right, exactly.
And it's so of necessity imperfect, always approximated, never ending finally.
That's right.
And I'm wondering two things about this. What do you do with the troubling stories about people who have instantly attained awareness when this question was answered? Then we're arahant through. And on the other hand, how does this differ from, say, Stoic teachings or that sort of class of philosophical meaning?
Well, I'll come back to this a little bit tonight. I think that Buddhism, especially early Buddhism of the Pali tradition, is quite close to the Hellenistic Greek, the Greek schools of Stoicism and Epicureanism. I think there's a lot of work to be done on seeing what parallels there are. Have you read Pierre Hadot, Philosophy as a Way of Life? It's very, very good. And it is looking at the practice of philosophy as understood in ancient Greece as really a practice, something that you do, not a theoretical view, which has been lost in our culture. But I think there are many, many parallels. In terms of the texts where the Buddha gives a talk and then it says, and 500 of the audience then became stream entrants and 500 became arhats, I think that's probably somewhat of a rhetorical flourish, but I think it might also point to something rather important, namely that perhaps these attainments are not as remote and out of reach as we often think they are. I mean, a question I've asked myself all the time I've been doing this is, how far away from my present experience is the experience, say, of stream entry? How do you make that choice, that judgment? Is it something relatively close, as you pick up, say, in Zen, and in some of the other traditions? It's just a question of a suddenly learning to see things from another perspective that could happen instantaneously. I think that the many traditions would bear that out. But of course, it's not something that then will necessarily last forever, or even for more than a few moments. So it's very difficult to locate where you as a person stand in relation to these attainments that are described. And as tradition has evolved, I think this is true in most religions, is that the goals of the practice and the tradition tend to become located further and further and further away from the immediate experience of the ordinary person. They very often become the privileged preserve of those in power, namely the monks and the priests and the lamas and the roshis and so on. And I think a very good critique of that whole thing is found in Marx and in Feuerbach, who see religion as a system of alienation that is very often utilized as a mechanism within a power structure. Now, Buddhism has never really thought about things that way, but I found that very helpful.
There is an interesting, in the Pali Canon, at one point somebody asked the Buddha, but how can I really know that a monk or a nun is really from your lineage and really is a great person, etc., etc., etc.? And so the Buddha said, someone is from the Dharma lineage, the Buddhist lineage, and is a great person to be trusted, da, 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 if, so here you're really waiting for something big, right? Quite big. He's really the top dog, really good. If he is content with his food and doesn't think, oh, I don't like this, I want that. He's content with his clothes and not saying, oh, I want that clothes, oh, I don't want that, I prefer that one. He's content with his logic and practices the Dharma.
Well, cultivates, it has a delight in bhavana, a delight
practice
in
meditation.
Cultivation.
That's a criteria. But generally, we're not told that. We're not told this is a criteria. We're generally told many more things. You see, again, in Zen, you have this story you must have heard about, which is relatively famous, where you have a monk who is doing something in the field, and then he hit a stone, which hit a bamboo, and ping, and he's awakened. Why don't they don't tell you that he's been doing meditation for the last 15 years, first? Second, what they don't, what he says is, oh, it was there all the time. So he's not realizing something which was really back to the Christmas tree. He's realizing, oh, it was in front of my nose. And it's just, again, to me, it's more about de-grasping. It's about releasing, which means you're not a different person. But there is less that holding, that fixing, which create tension and limitation. And there is more. And so in a way, then it's back to, again, degree and circumstances. All of us have felt at times very wise, very compassionate. I'm sure of that. All of us. Especially in the right circumstances. We're healthy, we're not stressed, we're not busy, we feel fine. Somebody comes for help and we're totally there and we're really right there. 100% white wisdom and compassion. Take the same person, they've not slept, they're ill, everything is going difficult. I mean, they can do a little bit, but possibly it will be a little, take a little more energy to go to the 100%. So I think we have to be careful of kind of, it's like this, he's awakened, wow. Or he's not. It seems to me it's more a kind of a question of how much we grasp or not. And then the circumstances in which we find ourselves, which might help us to grasp less or make us grasp more. Quickly, because I think some, if we want to have, if you want to have this thing, we should maybe stop.
Two questions. One about the suffering.
Uh-huh.
Is I find it more difficult not to be overwhelmed by suffering.
Uh-huh.
Not this is the first one, and to the unrelated. Do you think that Buddha actually was kind of criticizing the society in his time? Because you mentioned Feuerbach and Marx, and because actually the Buddhism carry much of the Hinduism. Of
yes.
So
well, the question of suffering and it being overwhelming and so on, I will deal with that this evening. The question about whether the Buddha was a critic of the prevailing beliefs and culture of his time, I think he was, and I think there's plenty of evidence for that. But it is also the case that Buddhism, as we have inherited it, has also carried with it many elements of Brahmanical culture, quite definitely. And I think as Buddhism developed, particularly when it, in certain forms of Mahayana Buddhism, it became less, more and more indistinguishable from Brahmanic practice. And that's one of the reasons Buddhism didn't survive, because it was difficult to really see what was much different about it. It was somehow reabsorbed into the matrix of Indian thought by about the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries. Not entirely, but significantly. But I think we have to stop now.
Yeah.
And so supper will be at 5:45.
Yeah.
And the Kabbalt Shabbat is now.
And then the talk will seven. Stevens will give the talk at 7.
Yeah, at 7. So we'll meet back here at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Going to the
color.